Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This time on Vet Story.
CIA official was quoted as saying and speculating as to what kind of response President Bush would receive today. It will be like Elvis has returned. The king is here. And as many of you may not know, he was also the first agency head to take the employee elevator to his office every morning rather than the director's private elevator.
Thank you for those overly kind remarks. And I would have used the other elevator, but I was here such a short time, I didn't know it was there. They hid it from me.
That he's an incredibly capable man who has handled every task that the country has called upon him with great class and dignity.
That all of this hoopla was a little overwhelming, and all I can say is that the gratitude in my heart literally knows no bounds. I left here some 22 years ago after a limited tenure. That my stay here had a major impact on me. CIA became part of my heartbeat back then, and it's never gone away. It is an honor to stand here and be counted among you. Thank you very, very much.
Welcome to Vet Story. I'm your host, Phil Briggs. Today we'll talk about President George H.W. Bush, his legacy, and why being a member of the intelligence community may have shaped the history of the world. As president, George H.W. Bush's legacy is one of great leadership and the kind of sincerity we see reflected in our citizens old enough to remember a country less divided, and the citizens we call members of the greatest generation. I talked with Matthew Dalek, an associate professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, about why his legacy is so significant in American history.
Well, I think he will go down in history for a few different reasons. I think first and foremost is on the foreign policy front, and in particular as a president who really helped in a significant way manage the transition to the post-Cold War world, and was able to negotiate deftly with Eastern European countries, with the former Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, help reunify Germany, and oversaw a bloodless and peaceful revolution in Eastern Europe in the former USSR. So I think that's critical. He also, of course, is going to be remembered as the scion of a political dynasty. There have only been only the second time that you've had, I think, in American history, a father-son presidential duo. Both of his sons, George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, were governors of two of the biggest states in the country, very popular governors, Florida and Texas, and really leaders of the Republican Party. And so I think that will be significant. And then I think the third piece is he is really in some ways a transitional figure within the Republican Party. In some ways, he was moderate is probably not the right word, but his views on tax cuts, on abortion, were more fluid. And so, for example, at one point he was pro-choice. He was not. He called supply-side economics a voodoo economics. But when Reagan chose him to be his running mate in 1980, he repudiated those old positions, and his career really illustrates, I think, the shifting character of the Republican Party, the move rightward, where issues like abortion and taxes, there's really no room for debate within the Republican Party on those issues. And his career, I think, reflected that trend.
Talk to me about his showing flexibility or his willingness to negotiate. There's long been the stories of "I will not raise taxes."
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes.
But then he did go and turn around and actually raise some taxes. That was characterized by the Dana Carvey character on Saturday Night Live.
Read my lips. I'm gonna raise taxes. There, I said it loud and clear.
Share with me what we can learn from that.
Yeah, well, the parties were a bit more malleable then, or a bit more ideologically heterogeneous. There were some more moderates in the Republican Party. There were more Southern conservative Democrats still in the late 80s and early 90s in the Democratic Party. So it was a little bit more, there was a little more breathing room for political leaders to make those sort of deals because they could find support within their party for a variety of positions. That's not the case today. So, you know, Bush was also pragmatic on things like supporting the Americans with Disabilities Act and signing it into law, a renewal of the Voting Rights Act. There were certain things that he did that no Republican president nowadays would be permitted to do. The party, in a sense, the activists, members of Congress, the outside groups, they would not permit politically a president to do that. So, yes, I think, you know, on some level you can say, well, it's admirable that Bush did this, but I think that there are structural reasons why it's very hard to do something like that today.
Is there something we could learn or something we could take away from Bush's example that we should carry forward in American politics and in American governance?
Well, I do think the idea that public service and a life in politics is not an evil path. It's not a corrupt path. And that, in fact, there is still some degree of nobility in doing that and doing those things. And that also experience can be valuable. Experience can be useful in navigating world affairs, in forging international alliances, in negotiating sort of legislative deals. And so the sort of fetish with people who are outside Washington, who are inexperienced, it's not altogether an unwelcome development, but I think, you know, part of aspects of Bush's record remind us that, you know, here's someone who was extremely experienced and knowledgeable going into the presidency, and that that translated into a set of achievements for the country that would have been made more difficult if he had been a novice.
One place that gave Bush that experience was his time as director of the CIA. Just how did Bush's time as CIA director affect the years that followed? To answer that, I spoke with someone that has a lifetime of agency experience.
I'm Nicholas Dumovich. I'm the director of the Intelligence Studies Program here at Catholic University of America. I took this job. I was recruited into it, recruited into retirement from CIA in 2016, where I'd spent 26 years as a career intelligence officer, and the last part of that is a staff historian.
And again, thank you for your time this morning, Professor. Eager to talk to you about this. And I found you on a video on YouTube.
Glad they released that thing.
I think that's where I wanted to begin this interview and just ask you about the importance of President Bush to the intelligence community and why he's so revered.
You know, at first when CIA heard that this politician was being named to be the director of Central Intelligence, and at that time the CIA director was also the head of the intelligence community, the CIA workforce was initially very skeptical. This had never happened before that we would have a politico there. I mean, intelligence really tries to stay out of politics. Intelligence loses when it becomes a political football. So this did not portend well, but George Bush comes and, you know, the workforce knew that he was, you know, the ambassador to the United Nations, that he had been our ambassador to Red China. So he knew something, but what they weren't prepared for was just how much he embraced the mission of intelligence, the people of intelligence. You know, from the very first staff meeting, he comes in with a newspaper, I think it was probably the Washington Post, and saying, look what they're doing to us in the press, to us. He immediately identified with the men and women of the Central Intelligence Agency. And in the first few months, he is going on the talk shows, the Today Show, 60 Minutes, Meet the Press, defending the mission of intelligence, the need for secrecy, at a time when all these things were being openly questioned in the public and in the Congress because of the congressional investigations going on at the time.
Now, to understand the climate of America when Bush became director, we'll take a listen to parts of a rare CIA video, the one we referenced at the start of my interview with Professor Dumovich. It was produced by the CIA in 2016 for President Bush's visit to headquarters on the 40th anniversary of his being sworn in as director. The video entitled, I Want This Job, George H.W. Bush and the CIA, was quietly published on YouTube by June of 2018 after being declassified. This excerpt explains perfectly the agency and the era Bush inherited.
We were the nation's villain, I guess.
This is the story of a 30-year search by U.S. intelligence agencies to perfect mind control.
It was a terrible time. Congress had it in for the agents.
Why did you do this? Why did you do that? We found this. Tell us about that.
Does this pistol fire the dart?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman. And a special one was developed.
As a murder instrument, that's about as efficient as you can get, isn't it?
It is a weapon, a very serious weapon.
It was this tumultuous era in which Bush went from being an ambassador to being sworn in as director of the CIA. A move which some of his friends questioned. They thought it was the end to a bright political career. And even Bush had his own reservations.
I'm doing a lot of briefing, reading some of the hearings from previous directors, questioning rather soft compared to what I expect I'll be running into. It's funny how the mail reflects the different moods. Some say they're shoving you into a meat grinder, a dead end, getting rid of you politically. We don't like it. Destroy you. Others are saying they think it's great. I'd be damned if I know right now which is which.
But Bush considered it a duty to his country, and so he took the job and was sworn in as the director of the CIA.
Welcome, George.
Welcome to the CIA. Thank you.
I remember that day very well. It was an uncommonly warm January day in 1976 when George H.W. Bush arrived at the CIA headquarters to take over as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
The duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
On which I am about to enter.
So help you God.
So help me God.
In his first remarks as director of Central Intelligence, Bush said that we must learn from the past, but focus on the tasks ahead.
Restoration of public confidence is essential if we are to get on about our important work here. But the emphasis now will be on the future. And because of its dedicated people, this agency is the finest intelligence agency in the world. They will have my total support, and I'll work hard at that. We are not in the policy business. We'll call them as we see them, and we'll be objective in our estimates. I'm determined to protect those things that must be kept secret. And I am more determined to protect those unselfish and patriotic people who, with total dedication, serve their country, often putting their lives on the line, only to have some people bent on destroying this agency expose their names. This must stop, and I'll do my level best to play a role in that. I want this job. I want to do it well, and I'm proud to be a part of the CIA. Thank you very much.
Now, he's obviously made quite an impact there with the agency, and he's sort of healed that wound and that mistrust of the public, and he's raised morale. Talk to me about going forward into the Reagan era and then what would eventually be his presidency. Why was he so critical, and what were sort of the maybe some good highlights or some good things that we may have not known about the real benefit of having somebody that understood intelligence in the executive branch for those 12 years?
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right. It's important to look at George Bush not as a guy who was just the CIA director, and then later on we find that he's the 41st president of the United States. But there is a 12-year period where he goes from being a presidential candidate, in competition with Ronald Reagan, to being chosen, I think quite wisely, as Reagan's vice president for two full terms. And then his single but extremely significant one term as president. What's not really known, sufficiently about George H.W. Bush is that as vice president-elect, he was already having a good impact on the Reagan team moving forward in the transition period, that it was George Bush, the former CIA director, who prevailed upon President-elect Ronald Reagan to start receiving the president's daily brief, which had been offered by the Carter administration. Go ahead and receive it, and using all the resources of the American government, basically Reagan is still in California, and they're flying out the book, the president's daily brief, which is a magnificent publication. I was its editor for 3 years during the Clinton administration. It's an experience I'll never forget. But they got the PDB, as we call it, the President's Daily Brief, out to Reagan, and with agency briefers interacting with him and finding that, hey, this former actor is not as dumb as we thought. He's actually pretty engaged in and knowledgeable about the world, and he's open to new ideas. That was a measure of Bush's influence that was very positive. And he continued to encourage the production of intelligence going to Ronald Reagan, who, by the way, this isn't about Reagan, but I happen to know a lot about Reagan because I did a lot of research as a staff historian about Reagan as an intelligence consumer. And Reagan was amazing. Contrary to the caricatures you hear about this guy not being a reader or interested in the world and in intelligence, he read voraciously. I looked at all his PDBs for the first 3 years of his presidency, and they're marked up, you know. He engaged intellectually with these things. He asked for more. And I think that behind the scenes, you had George H.W. Bush, who has his own national security team, is facilitating some of that, is because of his ties, George Bush's ties back with the agency. His national security advisor, Don Gregg, friend of mine, is a retired CIA officer, senior officer, who that's his channel back to the agency. I'm 95% certain that using that channel, that they tailored some things for the president's attention that would appear in the book that they knew that Ronald Reagan was reading every single day.
Wow.
So I think I think you have a behind the scenes and characteristic of George H.W. Bush. You don't hear about this. He never takes credit for this sort of thing. It's just the right thing to do, the important thing to do for the country. And so he's there, and he's, as you know from any history of the Reagan administration, George H.W. Bush was pretty much involved in all major decisions, thankfully, except for Iran-Contra, which was a disaster.
Yeah, that's a podcast for another day.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
And then when he wins the presidency, you know, this, it gets even better for U.S. intelligence, because now we have a president who has walked the walk, and President Bush insists on starting his day every day with a CIA briefer, with the president's daily brief. He takes an active interest in what's in the book and its distribution. Because of George Bush's experience as director, he knew that the president's daily brief had to be, you know, the most sensitive information for the president. But if presidents allow the distribution of the PDB to be too wide, CIA is going to hold back on some of that. And Bush as president didn't want that. So he actually went to the extreme, if you will, of dictating who would receive the PDB, and he kept it very small. And he said explicitly, I don't want this going wider than this small circle close to the president, because I know then CIA will start holding back on some sensitive information. And he wasn't disagreeing with the need to do that. He was fixing the problem by keeping the president's daily brief appropriately pretty closely held. And he also dictated specifically, and this is, you know, here's the president of the United States getting into these details, but they're important details. He said, and CIA, when you bring the PDB to an authorized reader, one of the principals, they call it, you know, allow the principal to read it or brief it to him, but you take it back. It goes back to the agency. It doesn't stay. Another way to avoid leaking.
Sure. And in this day and age, can you imagine with emails and everything, how loosey-goosey we play things these days? Having been to Langley on a family day tour, I can honestly say I've seen and found quite fascinating the various stamps and labels that they put on pieces of paper throughout history. And the label of eyes only, I always thought was a very interesting stamp on a piece of, like on a memorandum or something, because that meant that literally you couldn't leave it on someone's desk. You couldn't mail it in an envelope. It was for eyes only, and then it would go back to wherever it came from. Fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. So you had that, and you know, Bush as president, you know, he had this fondness for the agency. And if you saw in the video, the part of the speech that he gave, you know, as former president, when he came back in 1998 for the president for the agency's 50th anniversary, you know, we renamed the compound for him. It's the George Bush Center of Intelligence. And he said at that occasion that he wasn't here for very long. You know, he was there for 51 weeks, just short of a year. But, you know, he found that CIA's heartbeat became his own, and it's never left. And every time he would come back as president or as former president, people just turned out. They do normally for presidents, but there was a special love and devotion to this particular man because of what he had done as director, the support he consistently expressed for the people of intelligence, the men and women doing very hard things in order to help keep our country safe. You know, it was mutual, you know,
right.
It was this love affair.
Wonderful. Last question. Having been there, having been an intelligence officer for as many years as you were, Some would say that in the 80s, you know, as I recall growing up, every movie's enemy was the Russians or a communist. You know, there was Rocky and there was Red Dawn and there were all the movies I grew up watching. And of course,
part of
the propaganda of the 80s was the bad guy was always a communist somewhere. And we were always fighting Russians. And we didn't go to war while Bush was vice president with Russia. And in fact, we actually saw the breakdown of the Berlin Wall and we saw Germany's reunification to some degree, maybe as a result of our stance in foreign policy. But as Bush became president, we did see us enter a conflict with Iraq and Saddam Hussein for the invasion of Kuwait. It makes the argument for some that those that are in the intelligence community or those that are steeped in the Department of Defense as leaders take us down the path of war. Is there any truth to that with Bush in that we got closer and closer to war with Russia at one point and that by the time he became president, we actually did go to war? Or was his intelligence background actually keeping us from war?
I think more the latter. I mean, you know, Bush's personal history, he detested war. He had fought in war. One thing I know about Ronald Reagan and his presidency was that Reagan, again, despite the caricatures, was no warmonger. He hated war. He had, you know, there had been four wars fought in his lifetime. He didn't want a fifth, and he was working as hard as he could to negotiate peace, but negotiate from a position of strength. George Bush was totally in line with that policy. And, you know, with the end of the Cold War, which, I mean, the groundwork was prepared by Reagan, but Reagan left office before he could finish the job. George H.W. Bush finishes the job. You know, I'm going to say this because I'm here at the Catholic University of America, that, you know, it's a fallen world. It's a world in which there is conflict, and that's not going away until, you know, the better world comes at the end of the age. In the meantime, you know, it's simply not true that CIA was created to fight the Cold War. It did fight the Cold War. But even without the Cold War, as the Cold War goes away, all these other problems, which may have been suppressed by this superpower competition, but they're still there. They're still there festering. All these problems in the Mideast, in the Balkans, in Asia, they're going to come up. And the mission of intelligence, and George Bush knew this in his DNA, the mission of intelligence is to deal with the world as it is. We can't afford to, you know, pretend it's something that it's not. That'll bite us in the backside. So I think what George Bush saw with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, which the intelligence community did warn about, again, contrary to some of the myths out there, what he saw was a threat to peace, and that if the aggression was allowed to stand, then there was little hope for the world, because every dictator, every strongman would see that might actually does make right, and these people could move on their weaker neighbors, and we would have chaos, and we'd end up being involved in a lot more conflicts to protect our interests than just the one. So I think Bush had a strategic vision that if we don't stop this kind of aggression here and now, we're going to pay for it later in a lot more conflicts that perhaps we won't be able to handle.
Well said, Professor, and I feel like I just took a class in the 28 minutes. It would seem that we've covered everything from the histories of the mid to late 70s to, you know, two presidential administrations and one seriously great leader and, you know, a love between the intelligence community and Bush 41 that endures and that has taught us all a lesson. Thank you for the lessons that you've taught us this morning. Really appreciate talking to you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thank you very much, and thank you for your service and your continuing efforts to with veterans. As somebody who served in the Coast Guard, I think what you're doing is great.
And that'll do it for this special edition of Vet Story.
dedicated to the memory of President George H.W. Bush. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Matthew Dalek, Associate Professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. You can follow him on Twitter at Matt Dalek. That's at MattDalleK. Special thanks to Central Intelligence Agency's Public Affairs Office for providing us with the link to the video. Again, you can find that on YouTube. Search for I Want This Job, George H.W. Bush and the CIA. Guests on the video included Tom Brokaw, special correspondent for NBC News. Also heard on the video was James Baker, former White House Chief of Staff under President Bush. And special thanks to Dr. Nicholas Dumovich, former career intelligence officer at the CIA for 26 years, former CIA deputy chief historian, and a former editor of the President's Daily Brief. You can find him as a professor of intelligence studies at Catholic University. I'm Phil Briggs, and you can find my work at connectingvets.com, where you can click on the podcast tab and find all kinds of episodes and incredible stories every day. Follow me on Twitter at Phil Briggs. In the meantime, I'll be looking for tales to tell, and I'll talk to you on the next episode of Vet Story.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.